don't think we reflect enough on the Ten Commandments, which are so central to the Old Testament, and it provided the foundation for a lot of Western society. If we do think about them, we might aver more to what they call the second table of the law, the ones dealing with our relation to, you know, each other. So, honor your mother and father, don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery, etc. But the Bible clearly favors the first table of the law. So remember the image of like Moses coming down with the two tablets. The first table of the law deals with our relationship to God. And see, the Bible stresses that one appropriately because it always ties our relation to each other to our more fundamental relationship with God. See, everything in the spiritual life and the moral life will flow from clarity on that score. Look now at the very first commandment. I'm the Lord your God who led you out of Egypt, etc. You shall have no gods besides me. There is nothing more fundamental, nothing more basic, nothing more elemental in the spiritual moral order than that commandment. Why? Because everything will flow from what you worship. I very much subscribe to Stanley Hauerwas's view that everything you need to know about someone, you can learn from asking one question. What do you worship? What's of highest worth to you? What's of highest value to you? Everything else in your life will be read in relation to that. The Bible's intuition, and it's so basic, is God must be the fundamental value in your life. And when that happens, things will fall into harmony around it. Don't have other gods besides me. That's what it's saying. Don't make, you know, the big four I've talked about, the four substitutes, wealth, pleasure, power, honor. Don't make your country. Don't make your culture. Don't make a political leader. Don't make your family. Don't make your ego God. None of those things or people is of ultimate concern to you. They shouldn't be. If they are, something will get thrown off, will get skewed inside of your soul. Worship God alone. Now, here's a way to test it, by the way. Do you say to yourself honestly, pleasing God is what is most important to me? So you're looking at your day, you're looking at your year, looking at your life. What's the question you fundamentally ask? It has to be, does it please God what I'm doing, what I've resolved to do? If not, then you've got a problem. Then you are, in effect, worshiping something or someone other than the true God. I love that line, you know, where it says, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Don't read it emotionally as though God is falling in and out of emotional states or as though God is defending some prerogative of his. So I'm jealous because you've, you know, run off with somebody else. That's not the case with God. God has no needs. God needs nothing. Rather, read it this way. God is jealous because he knows bad worship hurts us. Thomas Aquinas said that the praise of God doesn't benefit God. How could it? God needs nothing. God's perfect. But the worship of God benefits us. And so he's a jealous God because he loves us and wants the very best for us. Look now at the second commandment. Don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Now, I know that can sound like, oh, fussy little Puritanism, you know, don't swear or be careful. Well, don't read it that way. Read it this way, that your speech, especially about ultimate things, matters. The way we talk about people, the way we talk about ideas, the way we talk about nations, influences very much our attitudes, our inner states. That's why, you know, when it comes to other people, we're very careful about speech and about language. Yeah, if you're talking about people in a very disrespectful way, in a very flippant way, if you're not attentive to titles, for example, and honorifics in regard to certain people, if you're referring to your superior by, you know, a nickname or something, well, what that's doing is it's shaping your interiority in a bad way. So with regard to God, how we speak of God, the language we use, matters. If we're flippant, blasphemous, disrespectful about God, then our own attitude toward God begins to shift in a negative way. Look at the third commandment now. Keep holy the Sabbath day. I think this is so important. You know, it's been around from the very beginning. What's being said here, I think, is this. you must instantiate the first commandment in certain definite forms of behavior, or it'll fade away. Love the Lord your God alone. Him alone you shall adore. God is number one. Well, you've got to instantiate that. You've got to embody that in some way, or that conviction will fade away. Something I've noticed, how much Sunday has changed in my own lifetime. When I was a kid, Sunday was a different day. Sunday had a whole different feel. The culture generally said, Sunday is a day of the Lord. Things were closed. You know, the presumption was that you didn't shop and you didn't engage in a lot of, like, you know, sporting activities and all that. You were going to church and you were, dedicated to the Lord on Sunday. Now, of course, Sunday's like Saturday. It's just another Saturday. People play sports. The kids have all kinds of activities. All the stores are open. All the gas stations are open. Why not? It's just another Saturday. It's a day that's been desacralized. Now, you also see it, in my lifetime, the huge shift in mass attendance. When I was a little kid, so go back to the early 60s maybe, mid-60s, still, I think, 60 or 70% of Catholics went to Mass. I think if you surveyed Americans, the vast, vast majority would have gone to church regularly. Now, of course, it's, what, 25, maybe 30%? The desacralization of Sunday is proceeding apace. Serious problem? Yes, because we're violating thereby the third commandment. You've got to keep holy the Sabbath, or you will forget whom you worship. Hugely important. Okay, what I want to do now is stop with that first table of law, and now fast forward to the New Testament. In a very particular scene, all the Gospels have an account of Jesus cleansing the temple. So in John's Gospel, toward the beginning of his public ministry, a Passover is approaching, and Jesus comes in to the temple. Now, what was the temple? It was the place where these commandments, the first table of law, were especially honored. Love the Lord your God. I have no false gods beside Him. No, you worship the one God. You keep His name holy. You know, the way people would speak of God in the temple, the praise of God on their lips. Thirdly, it's where you worship. You kept holy the Sabbath day in the temple. Jesus comes in, famously, looks around, and He says, you've made this house of prayer into a marketplace in John's Gospel. Worse, a den of thieves in the other Gospels. And then He turns over the tables. He cleanses the temple, purifies it. St. Paul said that the individual Christian, the individual body, is a temple of the Holy Spirit. It's very powerful, isn't it, that little description? That your own person, so for a Jew, when you say body, you mean the person. They weren't dualists like the Greeks. Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. It's a place where God alone is praised, where God is honored by speech, and God is honored by action. It's a beautiful way to think about your own life, your own person. So, here's the question. Imagine Jesus coming into the temple that's your body. What would He find? It's meant to be a house of prayer. Yourself, your person, is meant to be a house of prayer. What does He find? Does He find a marketplace? It's very telling, isn't it? A lot of false gods, power, honor, pleasure, etc. But I wonder, like, especially today in our society, if that's the principal false god, marketplace. How much time do you spend fussing about money, shopping, worrying about material things, trying to fill up your life with all sorts of, you know, things? Have you turned what's meant to be a temple into a marketplace? Now, there's a lot of other gods, as I say. Which one is really being honored inside of this temple? It's a good question spiritually. Relatedly, if you allow Jesus to come into that temple and look around and wander about, what's He going to find? Chances are He's going to want to turn some things over, right? That's why letting Him inside is a dicey business. Because He will affect change. He'll turn things upside down. Were the keepers of the money changers' tables happy with His presence? Undoubtedly not. was the temple establishment happy with his invasion? Obviously not. Well, you've got a certain temple establishment, don't you, going on inside of you. There's a certain way of doing things. Watch how Jesus, when he comes in, rearranges and upsets, turns upside down. Because he wants to cause you trouble? No, because he wants to turn that marketplace into a house of prayer, what it's supposed to be. A place where God alone is given proper praise. And see, that's the key to joy. That's what the commandments are all about. They're meant to make us happy. So let him in. It'll be a little tricky. It'll be a little unsettling. But he's trying to rearrange things to bring you joy.